Statements and opinions by guests of Mysterious Radio are not to be considered as endorsed by sponsors or affiliated networks. Any rebroadcast, reproduction, or other use of this podcast without the express written consent of Mysterious Radio is strictly prohibited.
Get ready for a night filled with conspiracies, strange places, the paranormal, UFOs, legends, and myths from around the world. With your hosts, K-Town, on Mysterious Radio.
All right, thank you for joining me tonight for another edition of Mysterious Radio. I'm your host, K-Town, and tonight my special guest is Nicole Wisenhall Egan, and we're going to be taking a look at the Bill Cosby case. She's written a book. It's called Chasing Cosby, The Downfall of America's Dad. Now, Egan's book takes a definitive account of Bill Cosby's transition from revered father figure to a convicted criminal, told by a veteran crime reporter and former senior writer for People magazine. Egan was the first reporter to dig into the story when Andrea Constan went to the police about Bill Cosby in 2005. Other news organizations looked away, but Egan doggedly investigated the case, developing ties with entrenched sources and discovering incriminating details that would ultimately come to influence the prosecution. This book is available right now on Amazon in Kindle, audiobook, hardcover, and also audio CD. And I start off by asking Nicole, why was she so determined to get to the bottom of the truth about this case and how it affected her as a woman?
So I've been in journalism since I was in high school, and I had 30 years in journalism, in newspaper and magazine journalism. By the time I left, let me back that up.
You're fine.
I've been involved in journalism since high school, and then I have been in journalism for the past 30 years since then. Newspaper, magazines, now books, and some freelancing. So that's kind of the gist of my career. I started out, I always did investigative reporting, even when I was covering a beat. I started out covering politics. And then when I transferred to Philly for the Daily News, I got put on a lot of crime stories. So I started covering crime and trying to dig beneath the surface for what was going on with these cases. And I got a master's in criminal justice at the same time, because I wanted to, you know, try to make sense of crime instead of just reporting on it. So I became like sort of the lead crime reporter. Whenever a big story would break, my boss would put me on it. And I had just spent the past couple of years investigating the Pennsylvania State Police for all of its mess. There was a lot of sexual misconduct among the ranks of the Pennsylvania State Police. And so I was in the midst of investigating that when the Cosby story broke in 2005. And my boss assigned me to it. And, you know, my initial reaction was not the cause, because I was a huge Cosby fan. I mean, I watched Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids growing up on Saturday mornings. I loved the Cosby Show. I write about this in the book that had, you know, helped me through a very difficult time in my own childhood. And so I just couldn't even fathom that he would drug and sexually assault a woman. But as I always say, you should go into every story you cover with an open mind. And that's what I've always tried to do. So I shoved my personal feelings aside and just set out to report the story and try to find out, you know, what was going on. And, you know, the more interviews I did, the more research I did on the woman who was accusing him, the more I came to believe the allegations were credible. But of course, as you're supposed to do, I kept reporting both sides. Before too long, there was a second accuser. And then by the time, you know, within a couple of months, there were 14 women total accusing Bill Cosby. And so I was thinking this was like this huge story. There would be this groundswell like there was with Epstein and Weinstein when these stories broke, and all these other reporters would jump in. And in fact, that is what happened a decade later in 2014. But at the time, it was like radio silence. The other media just did not want to touch this story. I was attacked for my stories by other media. The DA was threatening to have me arrested for my stories. Cosby's people were threatening to sue my newspaper and calling me and threatening to sue. And it was just like one of the worst experiences of my entire career. However, I didn't back off. It was just tough because I expected to get backlash from Cosby. I expected to get backlash from his people. I did not expect it from the rest of the media. I certainly didn't expect the DA to go after me. The DA is supposed to be, he's supposed to work for the people, as Tamara Green always says, who was the second accuser, but he wasn't. And for whatever reason, he wanted nothing to do with this case from the moment it crossed his desk. So there was just a lot of forces against this story. And I was going on some of the nighttime talk shows. They were having me on to talk about the case. And this is when I first heard the phrase trading up, because one of the bookers told me they were getting a lot of pressure from Cosby's people not to have me on these shows. And so what trading up is when you give up one story to get a better one. So pretty soon I wasn't on the shows anymore, because right then Cosby was in the midst of crisscrossing the country, going into all the inner cities and holding these town halls and basically lecturing Black people about how to behave. It was very controversial, but you couldn't get into it as a reporter unless you were invited in. You couldn't just go cover it. So ABC was one of the networks that just was not covering the sexual assault allegations against Cosby. They did one story about it. And it was like a pro Cosby story. It said that, what Cosby said happened between him and Andrea Constand is the same. The only difference is he says it was consensual and she says it wasn't. And then lo and behold, 3 months later, ABC gets exclusive access, Nightline, into one of his town halls, and the first TV interview with Cosby post case. So my guess is, and I can't prove it, that they traded up. So it was very disillusioning for me as a journalist, and to this day, I don't think I've quite gotten over it, because I was lucky enough to work for a newspaper that didn't back down to anybody. You know, there was nothing that you could say to my newspaper that would make them back off a story, except, of course, if something came up that showed it wasn't true. So I was sort of living in this bubble that most of the media is not like that, and certainly not the national media, as I discovered when I became a member of the national media. So it's just wrong to me on so many levels. I understand it from a journalistic standpoint, but I don't understand that trading one story to get a better one thing, or backing off a story that is something this serious. It's one thing if it's about a celebrity, I don't know, and who they're dating or something like that. It's another thing if it's about a celebrity who is committing heinous crimes against women and getting away with them for decades. And right. No one has the guts to stand up to him.
Wow, I commend you. There you go. For standing in the fire. You stood there and you didn't back down, and you stayed on it and you reported the truth. And so, damn, I love that. I really love that. Okay, so let's talk about, let's back up and talk about the very first one. So I want, you know what? No, let's go back even further, because I don't want to assume people know who Bill Cosby is. A lot of younger people that listen to the show, they may not even know who he is. So can you start off by just telling us a little bit about his background and how he became so popular?
Sure. I forgot to answer your question about as a woman, how did
I
feel? So one of the ways this struck home with me is a couple of years prior to this story breaking, I had done an expose on drug facilitated sexual assaults and how they were on the increase in Philadelphia. And it really struck a chord with me. I used to go to the comp set meetings. I covered Philly cops where they would talk about crime patterns. And I remember I was horrified because it wasn't too long ago that I was one of those young women dancing the night away at the nightclubs on the Delaware River in Philly. And to learn that there was a spike in, and I call it premeditated rape, in women's drinks being drugged and then they were being sexually assaulted was horrifying to me, because I was completely, that could have been me. It was just one of those that could have been me moments. And I never thought twice about leaving my drink and going out to dance and then coming back. I never thought about, oh, you better watch the bartender to make sure they're not putting anything in your drink. I mean, I didn't think of anything of that. And then to find out it is like the perfect crime, because it wipes out your memory. It wipes out your ability to resist. If you don't go to the hospital first thing, as soon as you wake up, the drugs may already be out of your system anyway, because most of these drugs are in and out of your system in 12 hours. So they won't show a trace of it. And what if, the guy accusing you is someone famous or beloved, or my God, America's dad? Who's going to believe you that someone like that would do this to someone? So that was in the back of my mind when these allegations broke about Cosby. And his reputation at that moment, at that point in time in 2005, was pristine. He had, you know, had this meteoric career. He was the first African-American to win Emmys for his show I Spy in the 60s. He had family-friendly comedy albums. He wrote best-selling books about fatherhood, about marriage. And he, you know, he created The Cosby Show, which through the 70s was one of the top cartoons that kids like me watched. And he created The Cosby Show, which was one of the most successful comedy shows ever, about this middle class, you know, African American family. And it was just incredibly popular, and just he became a household name. That's when he really became known as America's Dad. So now, you know, and he had just, you know, started this whole crusade. Really, he had alienated some of the Black community with this crusade he was doing, criticizing the way Black people, you know, were involved in crime and so forth. But that's why he started these town halls and was hosting them across the nation. And actually, that part of that is what later became his undoing when a judge came to rule on whether or not his deposition in Andrea's civil case should ever be reopened, because he had created this reputation for her as a person, as this public lecturer on morals. He even wrote a book about it after this case went away in 2005. And he won all these awards. He even won the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He just, like, award after award after award, always this great person. So this was the man that Andrea Constan was saying had done unspeakable things to her.
Okay, okay, so before you go there, is she the first woman that you mentioned her twice? Is she the very first woman that came forward to say that, you know, he had done these things to her?
Well, in 2000, now there had been another woman, a 19-year-old, who came forward, who went to the police in New York City and said he had done something similar to her, although she didn't say anything about drugging. She said sexually assaulting. But before too long, those allegations, she just disappeared. He never heard from her again. And I've come to learn, like, his routine in these cases, if a woman did dare go to the police, like Andrea Constan did, was to subsequently talk to them and basically, like, what he did with Andrea is he offered her a scholarship money because she was going to massage therapy school if she maintained a 3.0. And she did not take him up on that offer. Well, I'm assuming, and who can blame her, this other girl might have taken him up on some scholarship offer or money offer, because that's how he could make these things go away.
The very first one, this 19-year-old.
In the year 2000. And what was interesting, the New York Post and the National Enquirer got hold of the police reports. And so they got it through sources. Nowhere on there was Bill Cosby's name mentioned, which goes to tell you the power he has. Like, he can even keep his name out of a police report. But the address where the assault allegedly happened was, and it was his Upper East Side townhouse, which, let me just say, weirdly enough, is across the street from Jeffrey Epstein's.
Oh, that's crazy. We're going to talk about that a little bit, too, about those two cases.
Yeah.
But just tell us a little bit about what she said Cosby did and how she actually came in contact with him, being, you know, just 19 years old.
I'm sorry. So, okay, the case we're talking about that broke in 2005 was Andrea Constand. She worked at Temple University, where Cosby's like his most famous alum. He was very involved in fundraising, and he was very involved with the college, their women's basketball team. He did local commercials for them on Comcast. He was close to Dawn Staley, the coach of the team, and Andrea was director of operations. She had moved there from Canada after she had been playing basketball her whole life and had tried out for the WNBA and hadn't made it, and so was kind of realizing, I'm not going to ever play pros, so I can coach. So she took this job at Temple, and that's how she met Cosby. A donor introduced them at a game, and he followed up and was calling her, but to her, he was a grandfather figure, a mentor, and they became friends over the next 15 months. Cosby would later say in his own deposition that he had this eye on her romantically from the very beginning, but he didn't let on to Andrea, and that is definitely the case. It's like she had no clue that he, you know, had romantic feelings toward her. He did make a couple of passes at her, which she rebuffed. She said she wasn't really worried about it when a couple of things did happen, because she was 6 feet tall. She's an athlete. He's like 67 years old at this point. I mean, she could fend him off if something ever went too far. And remember, he was also on the board of trustees at Temple. So that's where she worked. And he was on the board of trustees of the university where she worked. He was a very powerful figure at her employer. So But then she came, there came a point in time where she realized she did not want to keep being a coach or even try to be a coach. She decided she wanted to move back to her native Canada and go to school and become a massage therapist like her father. But she was nervous about telling her boss, and knew Cosby was close with her boss. So she called to talk to him about how she should break the news. And he invited her over to his house that evening so they could talk about it. And she had been there alone and with others before. He'd held dinners there and everything. There was nothing unusual about this invitation. What was unusual is what happened next. And this is what I think is so diabolical about the whole thing. And the prosecutors have even said this. This was basically Cosby, I think, viewed this as probably his last chance to actually get her himself. I mean, she kept rebuffing his overture sexually, that she wasn't interested. So that what he did is she said she was stressed, and he said he had some herbal medication because she didn't take prescription meds. She's very into holistic therapies, holistic medicine, you know, didn't even take anything over the counter. But he told her these were herbal medication that she could take. So she took it. And within 20 to 30 minutes, her vision's getting blurry. She can't speak. He guides her over to this couch that's in the room adjacent to the kitchen where they were sitting. And he lays her down, and she can't move. She can't speak. She can't do anything. And he sexually assaults her. She's helpless. I mean, imagine being trapped inside your own body, and this is happening to you, and you can't do a thing. You can't. So that's what happened. And she woke up a few hours later trying to figure out, I mean, there was this total disconnect. Like, what happened? She remembered she faded in and out of consciousness. She sort of remembered it. She didn't. And she didn't know what to do about it. She couldn't even make sense of it herself because it just didn't. How could a man that she thought was this person do something this horrific to her? And what did he give her? She didn't know. She thought it was herbal medication. So she followed up, and she tried to get an answer from him a few weeks later about what he gave her. And he just made an obscene comment to her. Like, he's like, you had an orgasm, and it grossed her out. So she just left. And then she still had to be in contact with him because he worked for Temple University and he would call about the games, but she moved back home in April. And she just kept having nightmares throughout the year. She wasn't able to get past it. She came home, her parents noticed she wasn't the same person. She lost all this weight. She withdrew into herself. She didn't want to spend time with her sister or her nieces like she always did. And she was having nightmares. Her mother would hear her sobbing and screaming during the night from her own bedroom. But Andrea would never tell them what was going on. So that January, a year later, in January 2005, she woke up from yet another nightmare, and she was having a nightmare that a woman was being sexually assaulted in front of her by Cosby, and it was her fault because she hadn't spoken up, and that she called her mom sobbing and told her what happened. Her mom was on her way to work, and she had to get off the phone because she was driving, and she's like, oh my God, she had no clue this is what happened. And so that's what started the whole thing. She called the police, and then her mom's like, I want to know what Cosby gave you. Like, she had met him herself. He had invited her and her other daughter to a show when they were in Canada, and they'd gone and they'd gotten pictures taken with him. She knew that he'd been this mentor to her daughter. I mean, she couldn't fathom this, but she believed her daughter. So she called him to confront him, and he called her back a couple of days later, and he ended up apologizing and telling her, I'm a sick man. But when he said he would call back to check on Andrea the next time, and that's when she recorded it, because her son-in-law is a cop, and she talked to the police handling the case, and they suggested it. So she recorded it, because she had said, what did you give my daughter? Because she was like, well, how did you know she was going to wake up? Why didn't you call 911? Because that's the whole thing here. People forget that these drugs are dangerous to give to someone. They can kill you. I mean, what if she was on something else and interacted? What if she had an allergy? You know, it is extremely dangerous to drug someone without their knowledge or consent. And so she asked him what drug it was he gave her daughter. And he said, oh, it's on a prescription bottle. I can't read it because I can't, I don't have my glasses. So I will write it down on a piece of paper and mail it to you. And that became like the second version of what he said he gave her. And the third one, when he eventually spoke to police, was he claimed it was Benadryl. But first he told Andrea it was herbal blue pills. He told her mom it was a prescription, but he couldn't read the name of it. And then he told police it was Benadryl.
All right. So, wow, that is just evil. That's evil stuff. Okay, so he gave her the drug. He basically admitted that over the phone call, and You just to clarify this, they made a report, but his name was not actually on that particular report. Is that right?
No. That was the earlier one in 2000. I'm sorry. Okay. So, no, in 2005, a story leaked on the local news, a Channel 10 reporter in Philly, Harry Hairston. He had family members, from what I understand it, within the Philly Police Department. And even though Philly Police wasn't handling this, it traveled jurisdictions because she reported it in Canada. So she reported it there. But they said, actually, it needs to be reported to the police where this happened. And they erroneously sent it to Philly, thinking it was a Philly case. When it wasn't, because he lives just outside Philly. So it sat there for 4 days. And let me tell you, the Philly Police Department leaks like a sieve. I covered it for years. And then it went to Montgomery County, right outside Philly, and Cheltenham Township Police. So the reason I say that is this reporter had family members within the Philly Police Department. And I think that's how he got it. And he got a tip that this woman had reported these allegations against Bill Cosby. So it went on the news. Otherwise, I wonder if any of us would have ever known, because the DA so clearly, who was overseeing this, wanted nothing to do with this case. And I really wonder if it hadn't leaked to the press that way, if it just would have quietly gone away.
It probably would have. I'm guessing it would have. Let me ask you this. So you keep talking about the drugs. So just to educate people on the type of drugs that were, you know, that could render someone just not able to do anything. I mean, what was he using on these women?
We don't know. He certainly is insane. He did say that Quaaludes. Okay. So he did say in his deposition that he would get Quaaludes for women he wanted to have sex with. But we don't know. Quaaludes would have this same reaction. It could wipe out the central nervous system depressant, and it would wipe out your memory and so forth. But, you know, so do the traditional date rape drugs that you hear about, Rohypnol, GHB. They all work in kind of the same way. And, they like I said, they're out of your system so quickly that even if you do go to the hospital when you wake up, they're probably already gone. So there's no proof in that way that anything happened. And they wipe out your memory. They wipe out your ability to move. They render you helpless against anyone doing anything to you.
Okay, so from your research, how many women did he do this to over his career?
By my count, and these are known victims that have come forward, 63, and the first known one is from 1965. But I believe there are many, many more that have not come forward. In fact, if you talk to each of the Cosby survivors, some of them know of other women victims who have not come forward. So I just think that's the tip of the iceberg. And as I delve into a little in the book, I wonder, you know, if there were women who got drugged by him who didn't make it out alive. Tamara Green and Becky Cooper, who was another Jane Doe in this case in 2005, both of them drove after he drugged them, and they don't know how they made it home. Becky recalled, doesn't even remember, her roommates found her passed out in her car in front of their apartment, and they got her up to bed, and then they checked on her for 2 days while she slept, because they just were wondering, you know, wanted to make sure she was still alive. And she has no memory of that drive or anything. Tamara nearly wrecked her car. She dinged someone, so she went and slept it off at this all-night place in L.A. And, you know, then there are ones like you could have an allergy to this drug. You know, you could accidentally overdose someone. Or what? You don't know what someone else has in their system. So in the book, I talked to some experts, too, about the dangers of drugs, you know, drugging someone without their consent. There have been cases where people have died afterward. But you would, you know, if someone dies in a car crash or someone dies of an overdose, no one really goes looking too hard to see, you know, what exactly they were given. They just assume they died of what it looks like they died of. In fact, my understanding is in autopsies, they don't even screen for like GHB and Rohypnol commonly. Like, it's just not, they have to, it's a special extra test they have to do.
Okay. Okay. Now, okay. So you said Quaaludes. I don't even know what they look like or anything. So, I mean, is this something that you put in a drink or something and it dissolves, or is this a hard pill? How was he getting it in their system?
That's the thing. With some was like a capsule or pill, and he would just say, take this, and they took it, not knowing what it was. Others were just given a drink, and they had two sips of a drink, and then the next thing you know, they wake up, you know, 8 hours later, and he'd done something to them. So I don't, you know, there's there's stuff he was putting in drinks too. And I don't know what it was. None of us know what it was. I mean, you'd have to like analyze those drinks, which is virtually impossible. But there, you know, for some women, like the woman who passed out for 2 days, there was a toxicologist who told me that sounded like fentanyl to him. Which of course is one of the drugs.
Is that something you can pour into a drink or?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I mean, some of these you could do that as well, but you'd have to have the type of drink. There might be a little bit of a taste to it. But yeah, there's some odorless and colorless ones as well that you could just slip into a drink.
Okay. So can you tell us about the Me Too movement for those that don't know about it, and then how this relates to his particular case?
The Me Too movement exploded in the fall of 2017 over the Harvey Weinstein allegations. Alyssa Milano, the actress, just said, I think it was when the New York Times stories about Harvey Weinstein assaulting women came out. He was this famous Hollywood producer. So she said, you know, just if this happened to you, you know, tweet Me Too. It was actually a movement that had been started by Tarana Burke back in 2008. So that's what that was. And it exploded and went all over the world. And, and the way it relates to Cosby is just mainly that, because first of all the women that came forward against Cosby, there were 14 of them in 2005, as I wrote in the book, like they were the Me Too women before there was a Me Too movement, even when Tarana Burke did it. I mean, this is 2005. But Cosby had the first trial under Andrea's charges was in June of 2017. Because what happened is the DA decided not to press charges in 2005. Andrea filed a civil lawsuit against Cosby. They settled that in November 2006. And then everything just went quiet. And I thought, you know, it's over. And it's done with. I moved on to other stories. But, you know, I kept all my notes just in case it ever came back up again. And then in the fall of 2014, Hannibal Buress does this bit about Cosby being a rapist. And a reporter has a video of it. And then that explodes. And that's what brought this whole case forward again. And it ultimately led to Cosby him being charged for Andrea's rape in December 2015. So the first trial on that charge was in June of 2017, and there was a mistrial. After a week of deliberating, the jury couldn't come to an agreement, so there was a mistrial. And the judge scheduled the next trial for that December. And in the meantime, the Me Too movement exploded, and the trial subsequently got moved to the following April. You know, I don't think it really had an impact other than it maybe made the public more aware of these types of cases and how it happens and, you know, and things like that. I'm not sure it had that. I don't really think it had an impact on the criminal case at all.
Okay.
Or the jurors.
I wanted to ask you that. Okay. So can you tell us about some of the more famous celebrities, were there any famous celebrities that came forward and said that Cosby did the same thing to them or not?
This is what's interesting about it, because and I get into this in the book, the victims he chose were like young women in their teens or barely out of their 20s, naive, just starting out in their careers, and he would approach them to mentor them either via their modeling agencies or some other way, or just their agents. But he was never doing this to someone like a Felicia Rashad or someone who was his equal in celebrity and stature. One modeling agency was sending him teenage models once a week while he was filming the Cosby Show in New York City for dinners and everything. And some of them later came forward and said they were his victims.
What the hell was his wife doing during this time? I mean, did she have any suspicions or anything about?
I have no idea, because, you know, she's not saying, she's his staunchest defender and she's the one issuing statements, you know, on his behalf. And, you know, it's a strange relationship. She never visits him in prison. She didn't show up at either trial until the defense closing arguments, and then she left. So I don't know what the true story is there. I really don't. All I know is, you know, every so often they will have her release a statement, and she did in a media interview last summer, which she rarely does. So I honestly cannot tell you, you know, what the deal is with the two of them.
Okay. All right. Now, do you know, I mean, have you looked at the similarities between the, you know, Harry Weinstein and Bill Cosby case? I'm just wondering, have you looked at that, and if you found any similarities between the two?
Oh, so the most famous, oh, about famous, but that's the big difference. So the most famous woman who's come out and said he did something to her was Linda Carter, who was Wonder Woman. And this happened right as the second trial was getting underway. She did an interview with the Daily Beast and she didn't name him, but she just said, you know, it's someone who's being, who is being held accountable for his crimes as we speak, and da da da. So it was clear she was talking about Bill Cosby, but she didn't really say exactly what he did. And it had happened in the 70s. So I assume it was when she was more starting out, not when she was actually Wonder Woman. And that was the big difference. Like, and I think the Cosby survivors didn't, I feel like the Me Too movement kind of ignored them because they had all come forward 3 years prior to when it started. I also wonder why them coming forward wasn't enough to spark a Me Too movement. And I speculate in the book, I'm like, is it because none of them were celebrities? You know, if they had been celebrity victims, like Harvey Weinstein's victims, would that have, you know, would that have made a difference? Would that have prompted other celebrities to come forward and, you know, and start a Me Too movement? So I don't really know. There aren't a lot of similarities in that. And I mean, it's about power and being able to get away with it because you have the kind of power and privilege. But Cosby using drugs to assault these women is what makes this especially heinous. Like I said earlier, I look at it as premeditated rape. Like, you are giving that person that drug knowing that it is going to take away any ability they have to fight you off when you come at them. And I think it's premeditated rape. And Harvey Weinstein is a pig, but he's never accused of drugging women.
Have you found that they both were, you know, they assaulted the same women, I guess is what I'm trying to say?
No, not that I know
okay,
of.
Okay, that would be totally weird and crazy. Yeah, this is infuriating. Okay, so let's talk about, you know, it's got so many interesting aspects to this case because you talk about how his team came after you for covering the case and things like that. Have you looked into how they were able to, you know, like, I mean, were they using blackmail at any time on anyone to keep, you know, some of these women from coming forward? I mean, did you find that at all in your research?
Blackmail? You know, not so much that. I think he had a pretty good history. He had a technique, which was, you know, first they offered the carrot, which is what, you know, Andrea was offered a scholarship and money to hopefully keep them quiet. And then if they, you know, if they don't agree to that, which Andrea is one of the only ones that didn't that I know of, then they, you know, they just came after her with all they had and they started planting lies about her in the media, and the media ran with it and did stories about her. And, you know, it's a tradition in the media that you're not supposed to identify a sexual assault victim without their consent or use their photos. And the media, mainstream media, soon began doing that in 2005. And Andrea never gave her permission for her name and photo to be used. It started with a Toronto paper, and then it led into other media doing it in the States. And when I was at the Daily News, we never used her name and photo until we had permission. And that was when I'd written a profile of her. It was going to run the day she filed her lawsuit. And I finally asked her lawyers, I'm like, can we run her name and photo now? And they said, yeah, it's fine. They said, what's the point? I mean, it's everywhere now anyway. What's the point of you not running it? Because it was. All the rest of the media had done it. So, but that's what they did. And that was the stick. They really went after her. And Dolores, one of Andrea's attorneys, has testified to this, that she believes, because what happened after Cosby offered the scholarship, he had his attorney, Marty Singer, and then someone from his agency, William Morris, call up Andrea to follow up. And Peter Weiderleich called and wanted her and her mom to go to meet him in Miami, where he had a show to talk about this scholarship. Well, of course, they didn't take him up on it. And Dolores was never going to allow that to happen because she thinks they wanted her to cross state lines so they could have her arrested and charge her with blackmail, like they had done with his may or may not daughter, Autumn Jackson. I don't know if you remember that case.
And no, I don't.
In the mid-90s, he admitted to having an affair with this woman, Shawn Upshaw. She had a daughter, and he had been paying for this daughter for years, denying that the child was his, but still paying her money to care for this daughter for years. And then he withdrew the money after the girl dropped out of college. And so she and her boyfriends tried to blackmail him, and he had her arrested and charged with extortion. And that's how that went down. So that's what Dolores thought he was trying to do with Andrea and her mother by inviting them to Miami, because they would have been crossing state lines. And then he would have had them arrested and charged with extortion.
Was that his daughter for real or no? Did it come out?
I still don't know. There's no DNA test that's ever been done.
Okay.
But certainly Sean seems to think it is. I've spoken to her. So, and the other thing he was doing, though, when all these women were coming forward, what he would do is trash them in the media. He would find every bad thing they'd ever done in their lives and then give it to the media and they'd run with it. And he started that whole thing again in 2014. Well, Tamara this time had an attorney who decided to sue him for defamation. But then what Cosby started doing is countersuing these women for defamation, or just suing them for defamation whenever a woman, who has the power or the money to fight these lawsuits. And the thing is, Cosby's insurance, his homeowner's insurance, was covering it. So he wasn't paying a dime for any of these lawsuits.
Wow. Unreal. Okay. Where do I want to go with this? All right. So you said that, these women were, you know what? I have to ask you this. I can't imagine he was doing this whole time and no one else witness some of these things that he was doing. I mean, some, you know, they might have, you know, observed him near these women and were like, you know, that's strange, or he's up to no good or something. Did anyone else come forward as a witness to say, you know, I saw him doing this, that, or the other?
Well, that's the interesting thing about this. No, they haven't, but there are, and we know who all these enablers, he had a ton of enablers. There were at least two different modeling agencies that were sending him their models, feeding him victims. There was William Morris, who's the agents there, who were helping to pay off the women who did come forward. There were people who worked for him, like Cam, his driver, who lured this one woman, Stacy Pinkerton. She was a flight attendant, and he approached her when they were riding in the van to the airplane, said, "Do you want to meet Bill Cosby?" And that's how she met him. And he was going to mentor her. And then he did the same thing to her. And, you know, he had a lot of people, and it was, you know, everyone in Hollywood knew he was doing this, apparently. After the scandal broke in 2014, Quincy Jones sent a text to one of the women who'd come forward saying, "I've been telling Bill for years to stop drugging women." And, you know, I listened to, there's a couple of comics. It was Bill Maher and Joe Rogan had a thing like a year ago, and they were both, "Oh yeah, we heard about this. So, you know, Joe heard about it in the 90s and Bill Maher heard about it in the 80s. So it was like a well-known thing in Hollywood that he did this, and no one ever said anything. I mean, there were some who just would keep their clients away from him, but no one ever tried to do anything about it. And it's a shame, because
he could have been stopped a long time ago.
He could have been stopped a long time ago. Yeah.
All right. So, you know, I'm thinking that, you know, there's probably many more men. I mean, I don't think that Bill Cosby and, you know, it stops at Bill Cosby and Harry Weinstein at all. It's probably more men in positions of power to make or break an actress doing the same thing. And they just haven't been caught. But is it your perception now that, you know, many women have come up against a decision to do something sexual in order to get work, or, you know, and maybe it's just been that way for a long time, or what?
Well, that's more like the Weinstein case. I mean, these weren't women, you know, that was more, some of those were more of a traditional casting couch type situations, from my understanding.
Okay, but Cosby's, so it wasn't like that, never that way
Cosby,
with Bill Cosby.
No, because he would call these agents and modeling agencies up and say, "I want to mentor so-and-so, you know, I want to mentor her as an actor. I want to mentor her as a model." And that's how they did not seek him out. He sought them out. And then when he gained their trust and got them in an environment he controlled, he would drug and sexually assault them. He groomed their families too. You know, the one girl, Shaylon, who was one of the five that testified, she was a high school senior when it happened. And she was one of the five that testified at the second trial. She'd known him for 2 years at that point. He used to come to her grandmother's house and eat, you know, dinner with them, and he'd bring pudding pops for all the kids on the street. So she had no clue what he was about and no clue he was going to do what he did to her, and it destroyed her. She went right afterward and told her guidance counselor about it. And she'd been like an honor student and top of her class and all that, and her life just went to hell after that. So it's a very different thing because he was choosing teenagers and he was choosing or women in their very early 20s, barely out of their teens. And that's what he was counting on, their naivete and also their blind trust. And hey, my agent said this guy's trustworthy and why wouldn't he be? I mean, you never heard anything negative about Bill Cosby in the media, especially as pertains to something like this.
Okay.
They thought he was who he seemed to be.
Okay, now it gives me a clearer picture because I was thinking, you know, he would meet these women and then the first night he was, you know, drugging them that night or something. But you're saying that he actually took time to be around these women for a long time, grooming them, grooming their family, earning their trust, and then he would do it.
Yes. And if you read the book, I tell those stories in the book because I wanted the reader to understand how this worked, that it wasn't, you know, it was a lot more diabolical than they probably know it was. They, you know, believe it is, because it was a very well practiced routine.
Now, okay, so can you just give us a little bit about some of the more shocking claims, or was he doing the same exact thing to all of these women? I can't imagine he was, but I just want to ask you that.
The method was the same. The first victim, known victim, was a woman named Sunny Wells. She was 17 at the time in 1965, and she was a virgin. And her mom was an agent, and her mom knew Cosby. She knew Cosby. She had gone with her mom to the set while he was filming I Spy or something a few different times. And one time when she met, he's like, hey, well, let's talk about your singing. She was a singer. Let's have dinner tonight and talk about your singing career. And she said, okay. And they went, and she ordered a Coke to drink. She didn't drink like alcohol. And anyway, that night something was in her drink and he raped her.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, he did it in all sorts of different ways. He got victims through like Cam, who I told you about, the one woman who was, some of these were flight attendants, you know, that he met on a plane and, you know, did this too. And some were young aspiring models and singers that he went to their agents and gained access to them that way. It was just all, or some were spur of the moment, like Therese Serenice, you know, just spur of the moment. He could read them. He could just see that they, and he, you know, Teresa said this, I think he knew I was just kind of this passive person. You know, he saw her at the hotel where he worked, where he was performing in Las Vegas. She lived across the street and she was over there with her brothers and sisters. She was still in high school. And he walked up behind her and put his arm around her and said, would you marry me? And then he invited her to his show that night. And she went, and he said, and they took her backstage. She thought it was going to be like a party afterward, they told her. And pretty soon she was the only person left there. And then he gave her a Quaalude and said, take this. And then he raped her.
Oh, wow. Okay. So was this like a one and done thing for him? I mean, or was he doing this multiple times? And then when he's done, he just breaks off contact with them. I mean, he didn't say anything about that, but how was that happen?
Well, I mean, for most of them, there was contact beforehand and then this happened and they didn't ever want to see him again, except when they tried to confront him. For others, like, one of the women who testified at the second trial, Lisa, like she didn't remember anything that had happened. Like she completely blacked out. And he was going around town in Las Vegas telling people like she was his daughter and stuff. So she still did see him afterward. She did not understand. She did not know what had happened to her until many years later when she saw some of the publicity when the women started coming forward in 2014. And she was like, oh my God. You know, with Beth Farrow, he'd had a consensual relationship with her and then she ended it. And that's when he did it to her. And I think she might've still seen him afterward. There's just, you know, there is a disconnect also that goes on in people's minds. They cannot fathom what happened to them. I mean, just think about it. You wake up, your memory's gone. This is a person you've known who's like America's dad. It just does not compute that someone like that would do something this horrific. And, you know, and then there's a whole other thing of who's going to believe me. You know, if I go to the police, I'm nobody. And he's Bill Cosby. Who are they going to believe, me or him?
Right, right. You're exactly right. Wow. I commend you. I want you to take a moment to tell my listeners what else they're going to learn from your book and then how they can keep up with anything else you're working on.
Sure. The book is a really deep dive into the whole case. It, you know, I told it from my point of view for parts of it simply because I was there at the very beginning when no other reporters were. And I, you know, just had sort of a unique perspective and I, you know, stayed with it through the trials up until now. And, but it will, it's a big look into how he was able to get away with this for so long, who his enablers were, why, I mean, even the media were his enablers. In fact, a bunch of them did mea culpas in 2014 after the scandal broke again. Even Ronan Farrow did one because he said he was ashamed of the interview he did for NBC with Cosby's biographer because he didn't ask about it till the last question. So he wrote a mea culpa. So maybe that's what, and you know, made him stick with Harvey Weinstein when he started looking at that. He said he was ashamed of that interview he did. So there's a lot in there that has not been out in the public, and there's a lot of analysis. Then there's a lot of look at the whys, you know, of how, why was he doing this? Why wasn't this scandal? Why did it take for so long for this scandal to erupt and all the forces that were sort of out there? And you could go to my website if you want. I have a second book coming out in June. I co-authored it with the subjects of the book. It's another shocking story, but I'll let the description speak for itself. And my website is Nikki, NICKIEGAN.com. If you want it. And you can see, you can buy the book wherever you buy books, but you know, I know it's on Amazon, and you, the second one is available for pre-order.
Yeah, I commend you for staying with it and reporting the truth. And I'll make sure I have the links in the show notes. Many blessings to you, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. I want to thank my special guest, Nicole Wisenc-Egan, for joining me again. And the book is called Chasing Cosby, The Downfall of America's Dad. And that is available right now on Amazon and Kindle audiobook, hardcover, and audio CD. I will have the links to those on the Mysterious Radio website, as well as other guests that have been on Mysterious Radio. If you want to see what they look like, and we have a picture of them, that will be on the website there. So you can go over there and check those pictures out, and also relevant links like to their social media and websites will also be on the Mysterious Radio website. I want to thank my producer tonight, Kim, and the Mysterious Radio team. I'm your host, K-Town. I want you to have a great night, and I will see you next time on Mysterious Radio.
Like the show? Get more Mysterious Radio on our website. And don't forget to visit our Twitter and Facebook page.